about horizon entropy and loop quantum gravity. Eugenio?
Thank you very much, Jorge, and hello, everyone. And I would like to say that I'm very happy to participate as speaker to our loop quantum gravity seminar, to our international loop quantum gravity seminar. I hope you hear me well.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, from here, very well.
Okay, so let's start. I would like to tell you about recent work I've been doing here at Perimeter, and the topic is horizon entropy from loop quantum gravity. And I would like to start giving you directly a one-page presentation of the main argument that I'm going to present. So we can go to page 2. The framework is the one of loop quantum gravity and spin forms. We have a surface and a link piercing this surface that represents the horizon. I consider a state, an equilibrium state, and a perturbation of this state, labeled by delta M. And computing the area variation associated to this perturbation is immediate. Delta A is equal to 8 pi gh bar gamma delta M. Computing the variation of the entropy is the topic of this talk, and the result is that delta S is 2 pi gamma delta M, and in this talk I present two derivations of this formula. And once you have this formula, you can express the entropy in terms of the area, and you see that in the ratio the inertia parameter neatly cancels, so that you reproduce the Bekenstein opening entropy formula. Now, I would like to start stressing the continuity of this result with previous research in black hole entropy in loop quantum gravity. So we can go to page 3. As we all know, there's a very large body of work on black hole entropy in loop quantum gravity. And here I'm listing only what I see as the key steps, starting with the pioneering work in 96 of Smolin, Rovelli, and Krasnov. And the theory, the ABCK formulation of 98 due to Hashkar, Bikes, Kodish, and Krasnov. In this formulation, one considers horizon states and the notion of quantum isolated horizon. And since then, there have been many developments, and what I'm going to present today is based on most of these previous developments. In particular, like in the quantum isolated horizons, I will consider horizon states, SL2C horizon states, and similarly to the case of isolated horizon, a partial decoupling between the horizon dynamics and the bulk dynamics. So this work is based on most of the previous developments, but I would like to stress also that there are two definitely new aspects. A new mathematical ingredient, Lorentzian spin quantum dynamics, and a new physical mechanism. The entropy here comes from, I would say, the RT plane, not from the from the surface, from the sphere, from theta phi, as in the counting at fixed area. Okay, we can move to page 4, the plan of the talk. I try to present as much as I can at the classical level, and then move to the quantum theory. So the first part is on near horizon physics. Classical near horizon physics. So page 5, let's start from something familiar, the Schwarzschild metric for a black hole of mass M. You can tailor expand this metric near the horizon in terms of the proper distance from the horizon that I'm calling L. At a leading order in the RT components of the metric reproduce the Rindler metric. Is there a question? Okay, I'll go on. So the Rindler metric. Now, the frame associated to observer at given proper distance is corresponds to observers that are accelerating. They are not freely falling. One can compute the acceleration. You have given the expression of the acceleration. And one finds that an observer at proper distance L is accelerated radially with acceleration 1 over L. And notice that something interesting happens here. The acceleration is independent from the mass of the black hole at leading order in L. Moreover, this observer sees around himself a stationary geometry, a geometry that doesn't change in time. In fact, it's the Ringler metric. Now, this fact that the near horizon geometry is Ringler and is independent from the mass of the black hole generalizes to the Kerr-Neumann family. We can go to page 6. Kerr-Neumann family of non-extremal black holes. In this situation, you can again consider the frame associated to observers at given proper distance and co-rotating. So the distance is smaller and the world line is give a tangent vector given by this vector chi, that is a killing vector, that is the sum of the time-like killing vectors, vector plus the angular velocity omega times the rotational killing vector. These observers see, when they are close to the horizon, see a stationary geometry, and their acceleration, again, is proper distance to the minus one, independent from the mass, the angular momentum, and the charge of the black hole. Now, this result is interesting and non-trivial. It is interesting because we are speaking about observers who see a stationary geometry, that is the appropriate framework for doing thermodynamics. And earlier in our quantum gravity seminars by Alejandro Spered's talk. And second, it's non-trivial because as we know by the equivalence principle, a free-falling observer would see locally flat space, and the Ringler metric is flat space. What is non-trivial is that an observer at fixed proper distance and who sees a stationary geometry sees a Ringler metric that depends only on its proper distance from the horizon. I'm saying that this is non-trivial because there's clearly an exception. The exception is the case of a extremal black hole, where the near horizon geometry is not Ringler. And a comment about the fact that we are speaking about the holes that are out there in the sky. We can go to page 7, where I would like to discuss briefly one of the most well-studied black holes, the one that lives in the binary system GRS 1915+105. This is a 14 solar masses black hole with a very large angular momentum. In fact, very large and close to the theoretical limit of an extremal black hole. And this is the general situation of a black hole. The angular momentum is very large due to the mechanism by which the black hole forms. However, this black hole is non-extremal. In fact, it satisfies the Thorne bound. Its angular momentum is smaller than a quantity that is fixed by accretion processes for astrophysical black holes. So this black hole is definitely non-extremal, and the physics we are speaking about is the one corresponding to observers who are very near the horizon, in the picture very close to the center, and co-rotating. These observers see a Ringler geometry, and this is the topic of this talk. We can go to page 8, where I discuss the notion of energy, of near horizon energy. And in particular, our variations of this energy are studied by Flood and Goshen and Peretz in a beautiful recent paper. In fact, we find a Comar-like expression for variations of this energy, and when you evaluate it for the frame corresponding to these accelerating observers, near horizon observers, you find that the variation of energy is simply variation of area of 8 by g times a quantity associated to the observer that is his acceleration, a. You can understand this formula as a near horizon version of the first law of black hole mechanics. The first law is generally formulated in terms of observers at spatial infinity. This is a version for observers near the horizon. And I would like to illustrate it via an example, the analogous of a physical process version of the first law. So the situation is the following. You are in a spaceship close to the horizon, and you are adjusting your thrusters so that you see a geometry around you that is stationary. When you are close to the horizon and you see a geometry that is stationary, you know that you are constantly accelerating, and the closer you get, the higher has to be your acceleration. So you are there in this spaceship, and I'm at infinity, I'm far away, and I let a particle of a charged particle, I let it fall into the black hole. And when the particle passes by your spaceship, the question is, what is the energy that you measure? Now, you can do this computation. It turns out that it depends on all the details of the system, on the mass and the charge of the particle, on the mass, the angular momentum, and the charge of the black hole, on your distance from the horizon. But it turns out that all these quantities get together in a very compact formula, that is the energy that you measure when the particle passes is simply given by the variation of the area of the horizon once the particle is absorbed, divided by 8 pi g, times your acceleration. So that's the meaning of this formula. And this is important, that's why I'm presenting it now in the beginning and will appear later at the quantum level. Okay, we can go to page 9. So now I change gears. I'll give a classical derivation of this same formula, but in the language that is familiar in the classical version of loop quantum gravity and spin quantum. I'll start with an action and study boundary terms. Okay, and I would like to say that this is based on work I've done recently with Wolfson and Wieland. So if you're interested in the details, you can find them in this paper. So I consider a region, a space-time region, that in the picture here is denoted by R. This region has a boundary consisting of two space-like surfaces, sigma and sigma prime, that intersect at a surface S, at a bifurcation surface. And this region is globally hyperbolic, and if you further evolve in time the surface sigma prime holding fixed the bifurcation S, you will span this wedge and get up to close to this blue line H, the horizon. Okay, so the question is, what is the appropriate action for this region once we fix some boundary conditions on our fields, in particular on the connection? As we know, the action has to be supplemented with boundary terms. So let's start from the bulk, the integral over the four-dimensional region R, and I'll write gravity in the formulation that we are familiar with in quantum gravity and spin forms. It's the integral of pi wedge F, where pi is a momentum conjugated to the connection omega, and it's expressed in terms of the B field and the Minsky parameter. And when the constraint B equal E over G is satisfied, this is the action for general relativity. Yes, and certain action with the Minsky parameters, the Earth term. Now, this is the bulk term, and here we have boundaries, the one at spatial infinity, and the three boundaries, the initial and the final one. And as everybody knows here, there are boundary terms associated to them that are given by the integral of the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. The York-Gibbons-Hawking term that has been studied recently in the first formalism by Yarsikar, Engel, and Sloan. In the first formalism for the boundary term at infinity. And here I'm giving a covariant version that we derived with Wolfgang Wieland. And this covariant version involves a scalar field T that transforms a vector TI associated to slices. Are you still there? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Fine. Very well.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so this is the boundary term, the integral of the surfaces. But here I notice that there's something new. There's a corner. The surfaces sigma and sigma prime intersect at S. And it has been known for a while since I was in the 90s that when there are corners, there are further turns, corner turns. These were mainly studied in the general boundary situation where you have a time-like boundary and a space-like boundary and they meet, they join at a corner. And while here I'm studying them in the case of two space-like surfaces that intersect. And what you find is this expression, I2, the integral of phi ij, our momentum, contrasted with the antisymmetric tensor associated to the surface S, that is expressed, is given below, is the antisymmetric part of ti rj, where ti I introduced it before, and rj is associated to the surface, is the normal to ti and the surface, times eta. Eta is a boosting angle, is the angle between ti associated to sigma and ti prime associated to sigma prime. Now, a metric version of this expression was found by Karlitz and Teitelbaum in their analysis of the horizon Schrödinger equation. And recently it has been derived in this framework inspired by the expression of the Hamiltonian that I will present later at the quantum level, the Boost Hamiltonian. And it has been derived in two different ways, as a corner term, as the work with Wolfgang, and by Lee Smolin, who derived it taking the three boundary term, the integral distinctive curvature, smearing out the corner and then taking the limit to a corner, and showing that again you get the same expression. Okay, some nomenclature. Boosts and rotations, so I'm calling them with this name. So pi ij in the expression for the bulk term of the action, you see that pi ij is the momentum conjugated to the connection omega. This means that via Poisson brackets, it generates Lorentz transformation. And in particular, so pi ij is the generator of Lorentz transformations, and in particular when you contract it with the anti-symmetric symbol epsilon ij, you get the generator of boosts in the direction orthogonal to S. There's another quantity associated to S, that is epsilon star ij, it is the dual of epsilon ij, space-time dual of epsilon ij, and when you contract pi with epsilon star, you get the generator of rotations. So I call it rotations. And let's go to page 10. So on page 10, now I present the Hamiltonian, where the boundary term is of the form minus h eta, where eta is the Hamiltonian, the horizon Hamiltonian that generates evolution in time eta, dimensionless time, recall that it's a rapidity, a boosting angle. And the horizon Hamiltonian is given by the integral of epsilon ij pi ij. Now notice two things. The first is that when the EPRL constraint, the one now of spin forms, but here at the classical level, the fact that E is U and G is satisfied, corresponds to the fact that epsilon pi equals to gamma epsilon star pi, or in terms of the notation that I introduced before, k equal gamma L, boost equal gamma rotation. And when you plug it in the expression of the Hamiltonian, you find that the Hamiltonian is gamma times the integral of this rotation generator. And notice this notation that I'm using. I'm using equal dot to mean equal when this constraint is satisfied. Okay, so this is the first point. The Hamiltonian is the integral, is the boost, and all the constraint corresponds to gamma times generator of rotation. Second point, when you write it in terms of tetrads, the pullback of the tetrad on full space S, you find it is proportional to the area of the horizon. In fact, the Hamiltonian turns out to be area over 8 pi g. That is something that we are to expect now. In fact, this is exactly the Frobenius-Perret's expression. Recall that this generates evolution in parameter time, in dimensionless time, eta, while a near-horizon near horizon observer, a stationary one, sees as a proper time, his start dimensions of time, and is given by a to the minus 1 eta. And accordingly, the Hamiltonian that generates this evolution is a of 8 pi g times acceleration. So this is our Hamiltonian. In fact, one can conclude the argument and add that this is really the energy that you would measure using the derivation of the first law of black hole mechanics due to Daniel Sudarsky and Bob Wald, where they consider the Hamiltonian formulation with boundary terms at infinity and on the bifurcation surface S, assume that the Hamiltonian constraint is zero, satisfied in the bulk, and they get a relation between the boundary on S and the boundary at infinity, and when you vary it at infinity, you get this also variation of this term on the horizon. That would be the version, the global version, the one from infinity. And I can similarly write a near horizon version and show again, and derive again the Froden-Gaussian-Peretz result. Now, notice something that happens all the time when you are in this first order formulation with tetrals that we know very well in spin comps. When you look at the Hamiltonian H, its expression in terms of the area, you see that it's the integral of E over G, and this is an oriented area. The oriented area depends, it changes under parity. And it makes sense to consider the a parity invariant formulation. This in fact has been considered in the context of spin forms recently by Carlo Rovelli and Ed Wilson-Ewing. And let's go to page 11. And I want to show that the change is minimal and immediate and interesting. So in this paper on discrete symmetries, they argue at the at the classical and the quantum level that there is a natural modification that leads to a parity invariant action. And this corresponds to having a sign of the tetrad in the action. And on the boundary, it's particularly simple. It corresponds to having absolute signs wherever L appears. And in this form, the EPRL constraint, the simplicity constraint, is written in this form, k equal gamma absolute value of L at the classical level. Later I'll speak about this at the quantum level. And now I'd like first to mention something. When you look at this expression for the area of the horizon, this surface S, you see that it's the flux of L of this E field, the modulus of E. This, in fact, has been considered recently by Fernando Barbero together with Jurek Lewandowski and Eduardo Villasenor. And so this is the area, the positive area, that they are considered in the context of black hole entropy calculations in the quantum graphic. Okay, this concludes the first part, page 12. Now we move to the second part on the quantum horizon. And where I show you that there's a quantum system associated to this bifurcation horizon. So let's go to page 13. I would like to start giving you first the picture proper of spin forms. We have the Lorentz group, SL2C, associated to space-time, and the little group, SU2, the rotation group, the one that preserves the vector ti associated to space, and a map between SU2 spin networks representing quantum space and SL2C spin networks. This map is generally called the Y gamma. I mentioned it last time. And now in the presence of the horizon, there's a third group, the little group U1, the one that preserves both ti of the surface and ri, the normal to the surface, to the space-like surface sigma, and to the horizon S. And I'll argue that at the quantum level, in presence of this horizon boundary, the dynamic is generated by the boost Hamiltonian, the quantization of the classical Hamiltonian that I introduced before. Okay, so this is the picture, and to give you some more details, I should introduce some mathematics. Let's go to page 14. This Hamiltonian is realized at the quantum level as an Hermitian operator that acts in a Hilbert space. It is the Hilbert space of unitary representations of the Lorentz group. And yeah, I'll present it in this new way in terms of the parity invariant EPRL constraint. I should mention that I'm not modifying the formulation of spin forms. This is the familiar formulation. I'm just making use of something that has been noticed by Yasha Niemann. That is, spin forms are already parity invariant. So even if we never really mention this, in fact, the representations that appear are always of the kind that I'm writing here. So some nomenclature. There's representations of the Lorentz group. They are labeled by a real number p and an half integer k. Here I'm considering the representation space vpk, direct sum v minus pk. This is parity invariant, is centric itself by parity, and I'm calling an orthonormal basis of this space pkjm, where I'm using its decomposition in terms of SU2 blocks associated to the timeless vector ti. And now I can give you the parity invariant map, y gamma, that sends the state jm into a state that I'm still calling Jm. There's no ambiguity, so I can do this to simplify notation. It is a state that has p given by the sine of m times gamma j plus 1 and k equal j, and belongs to this parity invariant Hilbert space. And one can write the projector from this parity invariant Hilbert space to the image of y gamma. And it's written here, p is the sum of m from minus j to plus j. Now, notice that on the image of y gamma, the parity invariant EPRL constraint is satisfied. It's immediate to check it. For instance, you can compute matrix elements. Matrix elements of k give gamma absolute value of m, and matrix elements of l give m, where now k and l are defined as follows. I call j, ij, the Hermitian generator of Lorentz transformations in this Hilbert space. And I can contract j, ij with epsilon or with epsilon star. And what I get is the generator of boosts and rotations associated to my surface S. It's going to become the quantum horizon. Are there questions up to this point? Okay, I'll go on. Page 15. Okay, now I'm ready to give you the system. I'll start giving you the Hilbert space. So we have a surface. It's going to become the horizon, a surface S. And I decompose it into facets that I call small s. And the Hilbert space of states is given by the tensor product of facets of Vj, Vjf, where this Hilbert space is given by the image of the projector P, and is a subset, subspace of the parity invariant Hilbert space V minus P, V plus P. So we have the states. Now I would like to mention in particular two observables. The first is the horizon area. This can be understood as the quantization of the classical area. And it's given by this formula. This is, in fact, the Barbero-Lewandowski-Villasenor flux area. And the spectrum is immediate to compute. It's 8 pi g h bar gamma, sum of the facets of modulus of m associated to the fandom. The second observable is the horizon Hamiltonian. It can be thought as the quantization of the boundary Hamiltonian, the inner boundary Hamiltonian that I've introduced in the first part of the talk. Quantization of these quantities is the method is the familiar one. The one used to quantize the flux operator in quantum gravity. IIJ in the Schrödinger representation acts as a functional derivative with respect to omega ij. The states are polymeric, supported on links with holonomies. So this derivative vanishes everywhere except when it graphs on a link. And there it acts as a generator of the group, the Lorentz group, in particular as the generator of the Gauss. So at the quantum level, the Hamiltonian is some of the facets of Gauss generator. One per each link you're seeing this surface. This is our Hamiltonian, and the dynamics, the unitary dynamics, is given by unitary evolution of states with this Hamiltonian. Other questions? Are you still there?
Yes, at least here we are still there.
Okay. Hi, Carlo. Okay, we can move to page 16, where now I study properties of the system. In particular, I want to start studying the energy of the system. Well, the energy is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, or the Boost Hamiltonian. And our states belong to the Hilbert space of the system, so we know their properties. In particular, they satisfy the EPRL constraint. That is the expectation value of the energy of this state, coincides with the expectation value of the area divided by 8 pi g. And now again, as before, when you express this energy, when you redshift this energy according to the proper time of a nearer horizon observer, you find the Frobenius-Perret expression for the energy. And now you can understand these are a test of this quantum system. I presented a quantum system and I showed that it has a property. And this property coincides with a property that we know it is a property of the horizon. Okay, so that's all about the energy, page 17. We are still speaking about the quantum horizon, and I want to speak about the fact that this system, this quantum horizon, is in fact a thermal system. It has an energy, and it has also a temperature. So what I'll do now is to show that this system has a temperature. Let's go to page 18, because I have to introduce first some mathematics. I'd like to tell you about a property of Bose and in cosmic space that you can find beautifully explained in Sorkin's PhD thesis. So let's consider a two-dimensional Minkowski space and a set of vectors, v1, v2, up to vn. And let's consider the boost that is needed to send the vector vn into the vector vn plus 1. And I'll call the parameter, the rapidity, boosting angle, eta n. And now notice that we have to allow eta to belong to be complex because, for instance, the vector v2 and the vector v3 are one space-like and the other time-like, so we have to connect different hyperboloids. And even two that are space-like and belong to different wedges require a complex eta. However, there's a property, a general property, the sum of all these parameters, eta, up to closing the circle, is always 2 pi I. There's a way to understand this result. It is to go around and come back to V1. You have to cross the light cone, this dashed line, and every time you cross this dashed line, you get a pi half I, and you have to cross it 4 times to come back, so you get 4 times pi half I, that is 2 pi half. Okay, just some Minkowski geometry. Now let's move to page 19. back to something familiar, the spin-pon partition function. I consider the partition function for just one face, a star that is dual to a facet F on the horizon. And the partition function for this facet is a product over wedges or group elements that are simply e to the I k eta wedge. And the sum of the eta wedge has to be 2 pi I. So that is just a number. What we are interested in is, in fact, not that, but putting insertion into that correlation function that I'm calling the GAB of eta. And you can think of them as insertions in a first integral or in the way familiar in the general boundary formulation in terms of a general boundary state associated to the boundary sigma 0 union sigma 1, evolution that I'm calling W eta, that is given by the path integral in the interior of this wedge, and the boundary state psi, and the observable statute on this boundary, as you see here in the picture, A and B, and the correlation function corresponding to insertion of the partition function is simply given by the space psi, that here is the integral over the outside of the wedge, AB times the dynamics W. And when you put everything together, you get this trace. And I would like to mention that this is exactly the same thing that happens also in quantum field theory, in flat space, as we show in a paper with Hallager that is going to appear soon. One can put everything in this language. And this correlation function can be actually computed for a certain algebra of observables A and B that send our Hilbert space into our space. And in particular, the dynamics W can be computed explicitly given by this hypergeometric function. And I know that people working on quantum field theory on closed space can read immediately from this hypergeometric function that there's that the system has a finite temperature, has a certain temperature. That's what I would like to explain in, on page 20. So the property is the following. When you look at the correlation function GAB of eta, you can either compute it explicitly and use it and see what properties it has, or notice the following fact. First of all, it is analytic in the strip corresponding to imaginary part of eta between 0 and 2 pi. And second, it has a periodicity property, JAB of eta equals JBA of minus eta plus 2 pi I. These two properties are called, a system that has these two properties called KMS, and these two properties hold for an algebra of observables. And systems that have these properties have finite temperature, and the dimensionless temperature here can be read in the periodicity. The temperature is 1 over 2 pi. And this is something that happens for quantum field theory in flat space. This is known as the thermality of the Rindler wedge that has been studied by von Ruhe by, at the same time by Bisognani and Wittmann in this mathematical language. Is a universal property for quantum fields. And what I'm showing here is that this property is shared also by the quantum horizon. The quantum horizon has a geometric temperature, a dimensionless temperature, T equal 1 over 2 pi. And a technical thing that I want to mention is that from the KMS property follows that the Fourier transform of the correlation function evaluated at omega and at minus omega, they are related by this expression here on the right. The ratio of the two is e to the minus 2 pi omega. Easy to prove, just use Cauchy formula for the strip and use the fact that there are no poles inside in the function infinity. Okay, so So what I'm telling you is that this is a mass at temperature, a geometric temperature 1 to pi. However, this is rather abstract, and I would like to make it more concrete in the next slide, 21. So how do you know what is the temperature of the system? How do you measure the temperature? Well, with a thermometer. So here I follow Urlu's work and introduce a two-level system with separation in energy delta epsilon and an interaction with the quantum horizon that I'm writing here, couples the two levels. And computing the transition rates between the ground state and the excited state of the system is immediate. We have all the ingredients now. You simply use Fermi golden rule and you get this expression for gamma plus and gamma minus, transition rates for exciting heat and very exciting heat. They are given by the Fourier transform of the correlation function. Now, as you all know very well, one can then look at the population at equilibrium. For instance, let's look at the population of the excited level. When it doesn't vary, it means that the ratio populations of P1 and P0 coincide with the ratio gamma plus over gamma minus. And using the expression for the Fourier transform, we find that this is simply the Boltzmann distribution. E to the minus delta epsilon divided by T, where the temperature, the local temperature, is H bar A over 2 pi. This coincides with the Urlu temperature measured by an accelerated observer. So what has shown is that this system, the quantum horizon, is in fact hot. The closer you get to the horizon, the higher is the temperature that you measure. You can think of this detector as a part of the quantum geometry, like a link with a, it is a neighbor of the horizon link, and it will thermalize to this temperature. Okay, now I'm ready to conclude the second part, slide 22, where I would like to tell you about the thermodynamic entropy of the system. We know that the system has a certain energy, certain temperature, and we can ask what happens in a process where I perturb the state of the system. So let me consider a process where the perturbation, there's a perturbation of the average m of a facet, Fm. The area variation is immediate to compute. The energy variation, well, we have all the expressions to compute it, is h bar a gamma delta m. In fact, it satisfies the general relation between energy and area. The temperature, we just computed it. And now we can compute the entropy variation, delta S, using the closest relation, delta E over T. And we find 2 pi gamma delta M. It is the formula that I gave in the second slide. And when you express it in terms of the area, you find delta A over 4 G H bar. It is the Bekenstein of the entropy. And that concludes the derivation of the thermodynamic entropy. So we can go to slide 23. So that was my second part, show that the system, that there's a quantum system, that has the properties of an horizon. I call it the quantum horizon. It has a temperature and it has a thermodynamic entropy. Other questions? Okay. So now, the question that I have is, can we go beyond this? So let's go to page 24. We have computed the entropy using closest relation. But since Boltzmann, we know that whenever a system has a certain temperature, whenever a system behaves thermally, the reason is that it has many microstates corresponding to a given macrostate of the system, given temperature or given energy, given temperature and volume, for instance, for a gas in a box, and the entropy counts the number of microstates, the logarithm of n. So this is what happens for a gas in a box, and the question is, the expression of the entropy that I gave, what is it counting? And in the following, I will open up the calculation that I've already presented, and and give you an answer to this question. So let's go to page 25. So what I'm doing is really opening up the previous calculation, in particular the one, the derivation of the temperature. After all, if the system has a temperature and has an entropy, the reason for the two should be the same. So let's look at it in the following way. Instead of working with general boundaries, I work in the ordinary framework with state specific class lines. And now, here on the picture on the left, you have a link that crosses the surface X, and it has a left and a right part. And there's a state associated to this system. It equals the Hartle-Hawking state. This state is, in fact, the one that I already considered before. And it has, it lives in the central product of the Hilbert space, left and right, and it is entangled. And as we all know, expectation values of operators acting only on the right Hilbert space correspond to trace over the left. For instance, for the area, if we measure it from outside the horizon, we find that its expectation value on the Hartle-Hawking state is simply trace over the right of area times density matrix. One can compute this explicitly, and one gets 8 pi g h bar gamma times some average m. I'm sorry. And the reduced density matrix is the trace of the left of the Hartle-Hawking state. It is simply a projectile, the product of projectors and e to the minus pi k divided by theta. This is for a single facet. For many facets, we would have just a tensor product of these density matrices. Okay, so this is the equilibrium state. Now let's go to page 26, where I consider a process, a perturbation in this equilibrium state. And what I'll argue is that the thermodynamic entropy that I presented before is the variation of the entanglement. So to be concrete, I'll consider a specific perturbation, exactly as I did before. So the perturbation is of the following kind. The equilibrium state is rho 0, tensor product of sigma. And the perturbation is rho 1, where one facet is found to have definite area, state alpha, that is jj. So its density matrix is rho 1. And its perturbation is small, quasi stationary in the language of perturbations of the color line. In the sense that norm of delta rho over the norm of rho 0 is of the order of 1 over n, so it goes to 0 for large n. Now, computing the variation of the area is immediate, is the variation of trace A rho, which is trace A delta rho, and gives you this expression. Similarly, the variation of the energy delta E is trace K delta rho, it is the second expression. And as you see, they always satisfy the relation delta energy equal delta area of 8 pi g h bar. And now there's the interesting part, the variation of the entropy, the von Neumann entropy, minus 3 rho log rho. So to compute its variation, well, take first the variation in respect to the first part, delta rho log rho 0, plus the second variation, but this vanishes because trace delta rho equals 0. Then I use the fact that projector P, P log P is 0, to show that I can take the logarithm of all the exponentials, they sum up, and you get 2 pi trace k delta rho. And if you put in expression for delta E, you show that I've derived closest relations from quantum statistical mechanics. Let's go on. Let's substitute the relation between k, between area and energy, and you find 2 pi delta area of 8 pi g h bar, 2 pi and 8 pi cancel to give 1 quarter, and that's the result, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. So, to conclude, page 27, the question, What states does the entropy count? Well, one state, just one thing, Campbell states the afterlooking state. This system, the quantum horizon, is not like a gas in a box. There's one state, the equilibrium state, the afterlooking state. We can consider the variation of its entanglement entropy, and this reproduces the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And I'll conclude here. Thank you very much for the attention.
Questions?
Yes, this is Fernando Barbero. I have one question. So, so basically, you get exactly the Bekenstein-Hawking law with no logarithmic corrections, whereas in every other computation that I know, not only within loop quantum gravity but also in string theory, you always get some logarithmic corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking law. Can you comment on that?
Yes, thank you for the question. This is a very important point. So my comment is the following. So first of all, I presented the calculation at leading order, and there will be corrections. And I can comment on the kind of corrections that I expect, that I haven't computed yet. So we are studying the horizon thermodynamics, the black hole thermodynamics, are seen by observers near the horizon. In this situation, we should never expect logarithmic correction. The reason is that logarithms of the area are non-local. They are not the integral of a density. When we are close to the horizon, we can only measure properties of the part of the horizon that is close to us. And in fact, what we see is just the Ringler horizon for a near horizon observer. And we don't know the total area of the horizon. We only know variation, we only know the expansion, we only know variation of the area density in processes that we can make near the horizon. This can be compared to the situation that is more often studied, that is, what is the thermodynamics of black hole seen from by observers at infinity? These observers at infinity can interact with modes that come from every side of the horizon. In fact, the calculation is much more complicated. This is much more simple. And in that situation, you find logarithmic corrections. And they are being computed using very robust methods. For instance, via the Euclidean path integral, Gibbons-Hawking, or via entanglement of fields on a background, and these are logarithmic and are given by the logarithm of the area, and they are non-local. And I think that this calculation, in particular Sense calculation, can be fully trusted. The situation here is that what I'm looking is a slightly different thermodynamic system. It's the thermodynamic system corresponding to observers who are near the horizon. So what kind of corrections do I expect? So one can answer without entering the quantum theory, but already at the semi-classical level, because one can redo the calculation at the semi-classical level. And you know that what you should expect is that entropy is the area locally plus integrals of area densities that are given by higher curvature terms, no logarithms. And you find them, for instance, applying the Wald's formula for the entropy. It is the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the field strength, S mu, ij, contracted with the forms over the surface. This is, the entropy is expensive on the horizon when you are near the horizon. So I think that the system is a lot simpler when you look at it close to the horizon, and in particular, I cannot have this non-local.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. Laurent from VI. It's a technical question first.
Hello?
Sorry, can you hear us?
You don't
press, because we're in the same place. So we are slide 15. It's a question about slide 15. So on slide 15, it is, I mean, the Hilbert space of state is defined as being the image of the projector, P. So, you know, some kind of slice of this big Hilbert space. And the, so now the question, the technical question is, then you define a unitary dynamics of S eta on the bottom of the page, is exponential I H eta S. But the first question is this unitary dynamics doesn't belong to image of P, right?
That's right.
So, okay, so then that's it creates some kind of puzzle in the sense that in order to develop this argument, you need to have these two operators, A and H. And A does really, you know, act on the Hilbert space of state, but H does not. So, I don't know, what do you think about, you know, this puzzle? So in that sense, it's not the usual, you know, thermodynamical analysis, because there's always this projector which is inserted there.
That's right. Thank you for pointing this out. This is a feature that appears all the time in spin forms. It's a property of spin forms. We have Hilbert spaces that correspond to this image of P, to boundaries, and then we have boundaries corresponding to all the facets, even in the bulk of our spin form, and then we glue them with Lorentz group elements. And each one of these group elements send us away from the solution of the constraint. So the idea is that we have projectors everywhere we unfreeze degrees of freedom, and where degrees of freedom are frozen, there's no projector. And this is what reduces the general relativity with infinitely many degrees of freedom to spin forms that have only a finite number of degrees of freedom associated to these defects, to these spaces. So the answer is this is the familiar situation in spin forms, where we always have a dynamics. This is the integral of the Lorentz group elements that send away from the constraint, and we introduce constraints on every facet, on every place where we can make a measurement.
So there's still a tension between, let's say, a purely Hamiltonian analysis of the energy, you know, purely Hamiltonian expression of the energy and area.
I agree. I agree. One cannot think of this as the system corresponding to the right Hilbert space outside the horizon, with a dynamics that does not connect it with the left Hilbert space. This is not the ordinary thermodynamic system that is isolated and coupled to conductor. Here, spin form quantization enters in a specific way. It is you have these bracket spaces that connect the two Hilbert spaces, left and the right, and they do this with these group elements, these Hamiltonian, and projectors. There's projector for every wedge. So I agree this is not an ordinary system with an Hilbert space and one Hamiltonian.
Hi. You made an interesting statement concerning some Hart-Rokin boundary states. Can you explain what you mean by that? Like, for instance, like the standard Hart-Rokin boundary state is somehow a, so let's say, formal solution of the Hamiltonian constraint, or what else do you mean by it?
I'm calling it the Hart-Rokin state because first of all it has the same form, and second you can derive it taking a Hart-Rokin, taking the informal expression of the dynamics. This is in the Lorentzian for Lorentzian group elements, and you can go to a Euclidean version. That doesn't mean that you take Euclidean spin forms. You should take Lorentzian spin forms and analytically continue the group elements. And the two don't coincide. as we know. And then you should evaluate this for the following configuration. In what Arthur Hawking do formally with the path integral is to take the Euclidean integral of a compact region with this boundary, where the region has a part sensing to the other via boost with parameter pi. And this corresponds to a state that is that coincides with the Minkowski state. Now in spinforms we can do exactly the same. So the picture is you have a bracket, a space, and you can split it into two. So if you consider the whole phase, you would have a 2 pi. When I split it into half, I get a pi. This pi times the boost, e to the minus pi k, generates an evolution from the...
Sorry, but where is the bulk in this picture? That, you know, like in the Arthur Hawking definition, one is integrating over?
Yeah, I'm considering simply one plaquette. I'm decoupling it from the rest of the dynamics. Well, in the spirit that when the rest of the dynamics is satisfied, if the Hamiltonian constraint is solved, this is what remains on the boundary. So, so my bulk in this specific calculation is simply alpha plaquette. Clearly, you are asking, does this satisfy some constraint, or is it the eigenstate of some Hamiltonian? And when you do it for Minkowski space, you have that the Minkowski vacuum can be written in this form, and it's an eigenstate of the energy, the time translation. So a good thing to investigate is if this is the analogous of the Minkowski vacuum. The analogous of a plaquette for a single link, it is if it's an eigenstate of time translation.
Hello, this is Alejandro from Marseille. I have a question on page 26. It's nice that you aim at the derivation of the entropy from a statistical mechanical calculation, but I don't understand in when you calculate the variation, are you holding fixed the number of punctures, or what is this n that appears on that on row?
Yes, you're right. Thanks for asking. So I'm starting with a given Hilbert space, and I'm considering variations within this Hilbert space. And I can prove here, I gave a concrete example, that I can prove that for any small variation, I get this result. But that to remain within the same Hilbert space. Now, clearly, you're asking, what happens if I change the Hilbert space? In that case, I would have a variation of n, and a contribution from the variation of n to the entropy, that is most probably the aspect that you are investigating.
That's the thing. That's exactly my feeling. That I mean, you're proving that variations that hold number of punctures fixed are equal to variations of the area divided by 4. That would imply that the entropy is a over 4 plus some function of n, which is exactly what one would get in the standard counting that one does in the microcanonical ensemble or in the canonical ensemble as we have recently introduced, but also I mean in the calculations by previously introducing the microcanonical ensemble. So the question is what would be just trace of rho log rho using the rho that you provide here and this density matrix?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think that we should investigate it. I I'm avoiding speaking about the entropy in itself, but only about variations of entropy in certain processes. But I'm clearly restricting to processes within the Hilbert space. And it would be really interesting if one could consider all the processes where the variation of n appears. And in that case, I agree there would be a chemical potential, and we would be in the setting that you and Amit have studied. And the question I would say is what kind of process or physical processes can change, and what kind of physical processes remain the same in their space?
Okay, thank you. Another question from Mahmoud. Can you hear me, Eugenio? Okay. It's just a consideration. Somehow, in the past, there was a lot of works on entropy and thermodynamics in gravity, to which you refer, Hartle, Hawking, and also your treatment of Minkowski. Could one say that, in a sense, one piece of what you're doing is those works were very good somehow physically, but they were all formulated in a context in which there was some formal functional integral or some non-defined Hilbert space. And now somehow you are showing that those formal calculations make sense within a well-defined Hilbert space, within a well-defined mathematical situation. Could one say that part of what you're doing is this?
Yes, I think so. In fact, I'm starting to try to think about it in this way, and going back to the field theoretical calculations and see where are the infinities there, and now we are, these infinities are made finite. And my understanding is that if one restricts attention only to variations of the entropy in certain processes, the results coincide. But on the other hand, when one does these kind of calculations in quantum field theory, everything is formal. In particular, when one does the Euclidean path integral, this expression is not well defined. What one can do is compute it semi-classically, but then corrections are large. In fact, even the leading term is divergent. So I agree. I think that one can say that this kind of calculation is a version of the familiar ones in of Alan Gibbons Hawking, but in a framework where you do have an Hilbert space and you do have under control every step of the calculation. Everything is finite here. And probably when you remove or take some the physical cutoff or take some limit, you get back exactly the same divergences that you would find in the Euclidean path integral.
Yeah, so two questions here. Yeah. Well, one is still on slide 26. This is just a small technical remark. Where does the choice of alpha come from, in particular the angular momentum projection, J?
Yes. So this state is the state, is eigenstate of the area. And I'm considering a process where I make a measurement and I find that the area is J. And what I did is to consider a specific process to show what happens. However, when you look at the derivation, you see that the derivation holds for every perturbation that is smaller. So what I'm giving here is really a specific example, just one that I try to find so to make the argument concrete. Find a small perturbation of rho zero. So here I did the computation, I showed the computation with alpha equals 3j. But you can consider any other perturbation. As long as it is small, the result will be always j. just the same, delta E over 4 GH bar. What you should be sure of is that the perturbation is small, the process is quasi-stationary. And in fact, in the beginning, I didn't know how to find one, so I've been looking for one, and this is exactly the one that I used in the calculation of the temperature when I coupled it to a detector. So the point, I think, is that the framework is very robust. One can make choices like what kind of perturbation you take or what kind of interaction your thermometer has with the system. But there are properties of this system that are so general that the temperature will be always the same, 1 over 2 pi, and the entropy, the variation, will be always delta E over 4 G, as long as you remain in this silver space.
So you're saying that the result will be the same if we chose JM with the generic M?
Exactly. And every other mixed state.
Okay, then the more general question is, so I think I missed where you are actually using the spin form dynamics. I've seen, of course, that you're using the simplicity constraints, both at the classical and quantum level. And at the quantum level, you choose the specific implementation of the EPRL. But what about the actual dynamics? I'm a little bit surprised that you actually need it, because this is basically a static process. If you're only considering a Schwarzschild black hole, then you don't really need the dynamics. And in any case, in the calculation, I haven't seen where you use either the amplitudes or the Hamiltonian constraint or anything like that.
Yes, that's right. So I use spin forms, but I use only something from spin forms, in particular the simplicity constraint, and the phase amplitude. I don't use the vertex amplitude. So the vertex amplitude will be something close enough to the Hamiltonian constraint.
In what sense are you using the dynamics?
So the answer is, in exactly the same sense of the ABCK framework of the quantum isolated horizon, when one says that there's a bulk Hilbert space and a boundary Hilbert space, and an Hamiltonian that has a boundary term and a bulk term, and when the bulk constraint is satisfied, the boundary term has this meaning and plays this role. Similarly here, when the dynamics in the bulk is solved, when you do the path integral that projects over a physical state, the boundary will behave in this way. And there's this partial decoupling that immediately gives the temperature and the entropy. Now, corrections to the entropy will come from coupling with the bulk. Corrections come from curvature, while temperature is already there in fat space. So I would say that the framework is and the reasoning is really the same as in the quantum isolated horizon situation. And another comment is we can look at the system, the black hole, always in two ways. And the way it has most often been looked at is from infinity. I'm a stationary observer at infinity, and I throw stuff in the black hole. And this is a very complicated problem because you need to solve for the all the geometry from infinity up to the horizon and look at perturbations and solve Weismann equations and perturbations of Weismann equations. And if you want to do this at the quantum level, you need the quantum version. However, what I learned from Alejandro Perez, from this paper that they had, there's a beautiful shift of perspective when you look at the system from near the horizon. When you are near the horizon, you should still assume that the geometry aside is semi-classical and it solves Einstein equations, all the quantum version of all this. But all of them don't directly affect the entropy. In fact, when you're close enough to the horizon of the black hole, already at the classical level, you don't know much about the black hole. You don't know its mass, you don't know its area, you don't know its charge. You just know how far you are. And to know how far you are, you do this. You are in your rocket, you adjust your thrusters so that the geometry around you looks stationary, and then measure your acceleration. One of the acceleration is the distance from the horizon, and this is the only parameter that will appear in all your thermodynamic curves. So there's a change in perspective that is making this kind of reasoning work.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, this is Daniel from Berlin. I have a question. What if if you include matter, like I would expect your partition function to depend on some matter degrees of freedom as well, right? And so this would enter the entanglement entropy, I guess, that you compute.
Yes, it's a very good question, and something in fact that I haven't explored yet. I think that in the presence of matter, the relation area and energy will still hold. At least this is what happens in a perturbative theory. So I think I should separate two questions. One is, what happens when you let matter fall into the black hole? And the other is, what happens if you have the black hole and some matter there falling at the classical level you cannot matter, and when matter falls into the black hole, this is accounted by delta E, and the change in area of the horizon is accounted by Einstein equation, by the Rashid-Urey equation, plus Einstein equation. And here I'm doing a calculation without matter, and I'm considering a variation of the energy, delta E. Now this variation can be due either to perturbation in the geometry, which is what I'm doing, the variation of the density matrix, or some matter that is falling. This second situation is something that I haven't explored, but I think that to be consistent with what we know classically and semi-classically, this should correspond to a perturbation in the density matrix. So I would say that the result at leading order should be unchanged. But it's a very good question. I think that we should explore it.
So on again, I have a question on slide 21. So you get two derivations somehow of this temperature. You know, one which is with this outer-looking state, which is based on one link, but relies a lot on the specific form of this outer-looking state. And then the original one you gave, which is in page 21. So here I have a question which, and it's kind of related to the question that Alessandro has, because here in order to compute the temperature, you have to perturb the horizon state by, you know, introducing this potential. And what appears here is this some kind of creation operator that you call phi, which is, if I remember in your paper, it's not going to be clear from the slide, but it's an operator that creates, it's changed the number n of punctures of the boundary states, and it creates, out of nothing, it creates a specific a new state, which is this JJ state there. So is that correct? That's part of the picture. And I'm thinking in terms of the derivation here, which is, I think, one of the most interesting derivation you gave in all your work on page 21, is also related to this idea of Massard-Parentani, that somehow, okay. So somehow you have, what's going on here is that you have some type of horizon state, and then you have a gas of a potential fluctuation of something else. And the thing is that here, I mean, you mentioned the thermometer, but strictly speaking, the thermometer is not is not the essential part. In Massard-Parentani, you have the horizon, and the gas is the photon gas. And the corresponding operator phi is the creation of a particle as seen by an accelerated observer, right? And then what Massard and the temperature you compute is the temperature of this gas that is created by this operator. So here, it seems to me that, I don't know, there's something which is key in this, in order to get this temperature, is the specific form of this creation operator, this phi, that creates one new puncture. I'm emphasizing that because, in fact, what you're claiming here is that what you're doing is counting a number of states. So I'm going back to the question of Alessandro, right? This derivation, which is on slide 21, it's not an entanglement entropy thing. It's something where you're counting the, you know, you compute R, which is the ratio of two populations. So it seems to me you're presenting here that the population ratio is the population of the thermometer, but in this derivation, Alamassa, Parentani, it's also the population of these typical quanta which are created by this creation operator, you know, psi. So it puts, I don't know, it's a question, how do you reconcile this picture which is here, which is very different from the one which is the entanglement entropy, because here now the number of states change, and also the fact that it seems that there is a counting here of horizon states as if they were the number of states created by this operator A and A dagger. And then, so it bears another question, why this counting? What is so particular about these states that are created and counted here? It's a long question, there are like three in it. But this is one of the key and the node of the whole computation.
I agree. So I think that the two derivations that I gave up are compatible, and that they are both of them due to entanglement entropy. Yeah, but clearly, when you look at the system from outside, as seen by an observer, near horizon observer, what you see is a density matrix. So if that's all you can look at, you will never know. You just see a thermal density matrix. It is like having a thermal system and counting states in a thermal system at a certain temperature. What remains unexplained, if you look at the system in these terms, is why the temperature cannot be changed, why the temperature has this geometric value, 1 over 2 pi. So I think that entanglement enters into the explanation of this geometric temperature. But once you have this temperature, you look at the system from outside, you cannot really distinguish it from a thermal system. And about the choice of psi in the transitions, I know now, I've realized that the response is very general. You can choose some phi or some other phi, as long as it belongs to the algebra of observers that send the image of P into the image of P, everything is guaranteed. Then one can ask, what happens if you go out, if you consider other kind of processes, like the one that Alejandro is suggesting? What happens if you change the number of punctures? So these are different kind of processes that change the Hilbert space, and there may be effects associated to them. And that may be interesting, physically interesting, because this is something that is not there semi-classically. This is something that is not there in any of the calculations that I know of black hole entropy and of the temperature. And they may lead to some property that is property only of loop quantum gravity, where there's also this observable the number of punctures.
Sorry, but here, if I change the number of punctures, because phi acts on the vacua when there's no punctures and creates one.
So in the version that I'm presenting now, that is the one that is most under control and completely consistent, phi belongs to this algebra of observers. And I'm picking one of these algebra of observers. So this one is not changing the number of punctures.
So you mean in the auto-looking type of derivation? But I'm talking, yeah.
21. So phi here doesn't change the number of particles, the number of punctures. I can show that even if it changes them going from the vacuum state to a specific given area, then you get temperature. But if I restrict to this situation, everything is under control and goes into this class of interactions that give correlation functions that are the KMS property. So in this case, I can make general statements.
So it was maybe by confusion, but in the paper.
Yeah, in the paper I have this kind of intention. So somehow this keeps showing that there's something robust is something that doesn't really depend on certain details. I think that what is key, what is really behind the result, is that there is entanglement. You can think of it as entanglement between the left and the right, or in the general boundary formulation, you can think of entanglement in the boundary space between the in portion and the out portion, entanglement between past and future slice. They are completely equivalent, and that's a property of the general boundary formulation.
A different question. There are two the different things. There are two area operators floating around here, right? One is the square root of the Casimir, and the other is the absolute value of LZ. Is that, just to understand what you're thinking, is that fair to say that the two agree, of course, classically for any surface oriented in the sort of XY plane? And there's nothing wrong in having two operators quantum mechanically that have some common classical limits in some cases. So if I get it correctly, what comes out is that the dynamics, sort of the angular dynamics, is given by one of the two and not the other one. Is that what comes out from what you're saying? Which not taking anything away from the sense of this from the different geometrical interpretation of these two objects.
Yes, I agree. That's the way I think about it. Yeah, when you have the horizon, the surfaces, you have extra structure. This extra structure makes the area observable. I'll say a Dirac observable. And you have extra structure that allows you to define the flux area. You don't have this structure in the bulk. This operator would not be even gauge invariant. It would depend on the direction. So I think it makes perfectly sense to have two different observables. We can even call both them area, like flux area and rotational invariant area. And what I'm claiming is that the relevant one on the horizon is the flux area. There are many, this statement comes from things that they come from many sides. One is that once you use the flux area, everything works and there's no approximation, no RJ. So it makes sense to use it. And in fact, it was studied before and it has many interesting properties. But the second one, I think, is something that happens already at the classical level. At the classical level, we know that once you have the tetrad, you have a surface, you can write the area of this surface as the integral of U and G. And now, when there's an horizon, the action has a boundary term, and this boundary term is the flux area, and this boundary term, and the entropy that you compute from this boundary term, in fact, coincides with the Wall's expression for the entropy. It is the variation of the action with respect to the first strength, integrated over the horizon, or the two formal over the horizon. And this is, again, the flux area. So already at the classical level, it seems that it is this one, the flux area, that is appearing on the horizon, even in the classical entropy. And that's why I presented it in this way. I think that it makes the presentation straightforward and makes sense to consider this as the area associated to the horizon.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's thank Eugenio again.